So who knew Moses, our friend that went to heaven about a week ago? How many of y'all knew Moses used to come in? Yeah. He was born in 1940, and in 1958, he was involved in a workplace accident in a lumber mill, and the surgery went wrong, and he suffered traumatic brain injury from it. But it didn't impact his thinking. He still had, if you ever talked to Moses, he had a very quick wit. It was sharp and funny. But it impacted his brain-body connection. So for the next 56 years, he suffered a great deal physically. He lived at the Timbers about a quarter mile from here. And he actually, I didn't know it till the funeral, he won a national award for disabled workers a few years back. And he used to wheel in every Sunday morning. He'd get here early and stay late. And he'd park himself right by that wall over there and would greet whoever came over to see him. He couldn't see much. He just saw shapes. But he could recognize who you were by your voice really quickly. And during the funeral, I realized how much I missed hearing the sound of his voice. He was a joyful soul. He loved to perch a toothpick right here. And to talk to you, he would reach over and then take his crippled hand and pull it out and then stick it back in. And I would just say, "Hi, Moses," and he would say, "Hi, Terry," with a little bit of a Arkansas accent and a musical quality of his voice. And I can hear him in my head. I can't reproduce it, but I can hear it. And I heard a lot of stories from his family and friends about his life. Just an amazing man. And in the memorial service, I thought about his 75 years of life, how his race was done. The accident happened when he was 18, and he was supposed to be dead before he was 30, lived to be 75. And I thought about 2 Corinthians 4:17, "For our light and momentary troubles are achieving an eternal weight of glory that far outweighs them all." And I'm telling you, Moses' troubles did not seem light and momentary to me, and surely not to him. But suddenly, as I was sitting there in the service, they did seem light and momentary to me, and they were actually to him. The weight of glory, the final experience of his salvation, was so heavy that his earthly troubles had become featherweights in comparison. And Moses had a life that anybody would consider full of heavy and long troubles, but now they had been turned into light and momentary by comparison. So we live in this land of faith. He lives in a realm of sight. Our ability to see things as they really are now depends on faith. Our ability to see our troubles in appropriate perspective relies on faith. And this faith, which is not faith in what we hope for, but is really not real, but this faith in what is real, even though not seen, is what allows us to live wise and not foolish lives now. And someday faith will not be required. Sight will take over. So faith is necessary right now, and it's also necessary and possible that our faith grow, that it's not just static. And so the passage today in Mark, we're working our way through the Gospel of Mark this year. The passage today talks about the necessity and the reality of growing in faith. Let me read it to you, starting in verse 35, Mark 4. "That day when evening came, he said to his disciples, 'Let's go over to the other side.' Leaving the crowd behind, they took him along just as he was in the boat. There were also other boats with him, and a furious squall came up, and the waves broke over the boat, so that it was nearly swamped. Jesus was in the stern, sleeping on a cushion, and disciples woke him and said to him, 'Teacher, don't you care if we drown?' He got up, rebuked the wind, and said to the waves, 'Quiet, be still.' Then the wind died down, and it was completely calm. He said to his disciples, 'Why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith?' And they were terrified and asked each other, 'Who is this? Even the wind and the waves obey him.'" And this is called a nature miracle. And for some reason, people have trouble believing that this could or did really happen. And there's really nothing except an unfounded presupposition that would allow anyone to say this couldn't happen. And the circular reasoning goes like this. Miracles like this do not occur. This appears to be a miracle. Therefore, this did not occur. And science, by definition, can't prove miracles are impossible. Neither can philosophy. And history and experience are solidly in favor of miracles. This happened, and the story is told like an eyewitness would tell it. You know, we don't remember in great detail every event of our lives, but if you take some monumental event, we tend to remember details. Not necessarily a trauma. Trauma can sometimes hamper our memory, but a really important event can enhance our memory, and we can remember it in vivid details. And Mark, who was likely writing down the eyewitness memories of Peter, mentions the position of Jesus in the boat, the fact that other boats were nearby, that Jesus was asleep on a cushion. These are called pointless details. I mean, they don't pertain to the point. And these are telltale signs of an eyewitness account. Galilee is in a basin surrounded by mountains, and the storms that come up are notoriously sudden and violent. And so Jesus had been teaching from the boat so he could have some distance from the people. He can also use the water like an amplification system. And he was tired. He said, let's push across the other side of the lake. And he'd been dealing with people in difficult situations. He'd been handling opposition from leaders. He'd been teaching, training, healing, exhausting work with people, physically, mentally exhausting. And so he wanted to get away from people and rest. And so as they traveled across the lake, he was so exhausted, even a violent storm wouldn't wake him. And sometimes this story is communicated like, well, what's going on is he's sleeping so serenely, peacefully, in such deep trust that even a storm wouldn't disturb his rest. And I don't really think that's what this is describing. I think it's describing a man, a God in a human body who's exhausted. You look at what's happened before this, he's exhausted. You know, there have been soldiers who have been able to walk and sleep at the same time. Not a good sleep, not REM sleep, but they've been able to walk and sleep because of days and days of battle. And so he's exhausted and the storm wouldn't even wake him. It took the rudeness of his friends to wake him up. And they were rude. In the NIV, it says, teacher, don't you care if we drown? The original form is more like this. We're going to be destroyed for all you care. That's the tone. So Jesus, the Lord of heaven and earth, allows himself to be subjected to the exhaustion we feel, and he puts up with rudeness like this. So he gets up from his prone position, and he rebuked the waves. And then he rebuked his apprentices. Why are you afraid? You still have no faith. And he had hoped that they would have more advanced faith by now. But the storm revealed that they were still leading out in fear rather than faith. They were going to get there someday. The day would come when most of these men would lead out with faith and not with fear, but not on this day. And they were terrified by what they saw, that the wind and the waves obey him. And it's difficult to imagine as you read this, how could these guys see something like that happen and not be completely fixed? I mean, why not be changed forever? But it's comforting to realize that no individual experience, no matter how profound, by themselves are going to change our hearts completely from fear to faith. And for the disciples, as for us, it's going to take the cumulative effect of many years, many choices, many experiences to bring about heart transformation. But the narrative is not just to comfort us in our struggles with fear, but it's also to challenge us to become people who are more dominated by faith. So we're encouraged by the disciples' weaknesses because we share those with them. But we're also to be challenged by the Lord's rebuke, because it's not just a slap on the face for them or us. It's really a call forward into something more than what we have. It's an opportunity to have a faith that is up to the challenges that life bring. And this book, the whole gospel, was written to a church being persecuted by the Roman government. And they were facing storms that threatened their lives. Some would lose their lives. And it's not hard to imagine how reading this story would bring great comfort to these folks as they were huddled and passing around manuscripts that they had gotten from the Gospel of Mark, and how it encouraged them. But do you think those Christians who were facing this fearful Roman opposition would read this story and assume that what it meant was that Jesus was promising to rebuke the Roman army and make them stand down like he did the waves? Do you think that was their primary application? How do you imagine they would apply this to their own situation? What's the most appropriate application of this passage to our lives? Is there some inherent promise here that Jesus will rebuke every storm in your life and make the wind and waves be still? Either subjectively, meaning that is there some promise here that you're going to feel peace in place of emotional anxiety? Is that a promise here? Or objectively, he's going to remove all causes of anxiety in your life. He's going to make physical, relational, vocational problems stand down like the waves. And to answer that, you have to ask the question, was the lack of faith in the boat, was it the result of them not believing Jesus would calm the storm? Or was it not having confidence in Jesus in the midst of the storm? And the difference is not just semantics, because the first answer assumes that every storm in your life is caused by a lack of faith. And if you had real faith, then all storms would be removed. They would stand down. The second answer assumes that God has purpose even in storms. And if real faith is present, we're going to see God calm the storm or not. But in either case, We're going to have confidence that God is present and active in the middle of the storms. And later on, these very same men were going to experience storms of persecution that would take some of their lives. The difference was, by then, they had become people who were ruled primarily by faith and not by fear. Now, I don't know that the persecuted church at the time of Mark's writing would assume Jesus was going to stop the storm of persecution. And if they believed that, then some of them were disappointed because he didn't. But I imagine they assumed that he could. And so when they read this story and they saw that he could just speak to the waves and they stand down, then I imagine they had confidence that he could speak to the Roman army and they would stand down as well. So if he doesn't, he has purposes in this. So if this passage doesn't promise relief from storms of life, what's the point? The point is faith. Faith is supposed to be growing throughout our journey. And the clue is in the question he gave disciples, do you still have no faith? And so there's the expectation that they had the opportunity to by then have the kind of faith that would weather a storm, trust him in the midst of a storm. The indication is not, do you not have enough faith that I will stop every storm and keep you from drowning, but do you not have enough faith that you can trust me in the midst of a storm? Disciples were afraid twice in this narrative. Two different results. They were afraid of the storm. They really weren't afraid of the storm. They were afraid of what the storm would do to them, kill them. They were afraid of drowning. And then they were afraid of Jesus in the presence of his power over the storm. So both fears were related to their lack of control. They couldn't control the outcomes of their lives. They couldn't protect themselves from their own death. And then they were small and helpless in the face of the power revealed by the Lord. And fear or stress like the disciples encountered can cause this, will always cause this cascade of physical, emotional responses. So you don't want to over-spiritualize this and just say this is a spiritual problem. These guys sitting in the boat thought they were going to die. And when you think you're going to die, something physical happens to your body. It's been called the fight or flight syndrome, but it's really fight, flight, freeze, or faint. And all four of those are possible responses. It's how God has wired us up. In the best case scenario, the chemical cascade that comes with stress or fear is very useful. However, when you have this kind of fear, like you think you're about to die, it shuts down your brain's executive functioning, which means your command and control center goes dark. So here's the question. If this is true, these disciples were overwhelmed by fear, there's this chemical cascade in their brain, why are they rebuked for lack of faith? I mean, if it's a chemical response, the Lord's being unreasonable here. Well, because the Lord knows how we're made. He made us. He knows that we don't have to just obey stress responses. We don't have to obey emotional responses. We have the ability, the opportunity to train ourselves over time. You say, well, that's not a very Christian, grace-filled view. Look at what 1 Timothy 4:7 says. Train yourself to be godly. Train yourself to be godly. And the Greek word for train is where our word gym comes from. Or gymnasium. You go to a gym to train yourself. You don't just go lay down in the gym and it happens to you. You go in there and you train your body, your reflexes, your brain, heart, lungs, muscles. So the response of the disciples to one fear event, the storm that was going to kill them, was really the result of them not having enough of what they experienced in the second fear event, which was confidence in the power of God. You say, but Terry, how in the world are we not going to obey the stress chemicals? If our brains are overwhelmed, they're overwhelmed. I mean, once the water has breached the dam, the water can't be controlled. And that's true. It's also true you can build a bigger dam before the flood comes. And so let's look at this in the purely physical realm. Is there a way physically to counteract the fear stress response, or do chemicals always have to win? I heard a stress expert speak last week, and he described this process, and I've heard brief many times, but he talked about the sequence of events that occur inside a person's body in a fear stress event. Then he said, but there's a way to counter this natural response. You ready for it? The answer is training. Training. So people become equipped to handle stressful events and situations like combat soldiers or firemen or whatever through training. They build these mental, physical, emotional, automatic responses that kick in when the stress chemicals kick in. The training is what builds a bigger dam, allows different responses. A friend of mine is a chaplain. I was talking to him last week, and he had a parachute jump badge over his by his cross. And I said, Air Force chaplains don't usually have those. Army chaplains do. But I said, why'd you get that? He said, well, I was assigned to a unit where they jump out of planes a lot, and so to be with them and be present with them, I asked the chief of chaplains for permission. I was given it. He says, so I was 40 years old, and he was going through jump training, and he said the trainees were young guys, so they looked like they were about 12, and so here's this older guy, and he said his first jump, he went through weeks of training, just making things become reflexive, so that when everything becomes chaotic, reflexes kick in. He said his first jump was a free fall, the roar of the engines, the wind. He said, I got overwhelmed with chemicals. And then he heard this 12-year-old say, trust your training, and he jumped. And what happened was the reflexes kicked in. Why did reflexes kick in? Because he had trained. So is growing in faith, is it magic or is it training? You say, well, neither, Terry, it's grace. Okay, it's grace, I agree. Is it grace in cooperation with training? Or is it grace that somehow like magic increases faith? Sometimes we detach faith from real life so much so that we don't know how to really apply it. Have faith. What does that mean? Grow in faith. What does that mean? We sort of don't have control over it or any choices in the outcomes. It either happens or it doesn't happen. If you're lucky enough to get more faith, good for you. If you're not lucky enough, bad for you. We don't know how to get it. We just know we need more of it. Or it turns into a psychological thing. Psych myself up. Have faith, have faith, have faith. If you're told to have more faith in a person, what would it mean? What would it look like? Say, have more faith in Joe. What does that mean? It means, hey, trust Joe when he does something or doesn't do something you don't like or understand. Trust him anyway. He's proven himself. It would mean, hey, don't believe there's a character flaw in Joe. Maybe there's miscommunication, misunderstanding. Hey, keep moving towards Joe in relationship and communication, even though you don't feel like it right now. Go ahead and keep doing that. That's what it means to trust Joe. How does faith happen? It's not magic, it's training. It happens through time, choices, experiences, correct thinking. Train yourself to be godly. Training is a word that implies holistic efforts. God's given us mind. He's given us emotional capacity, will, choices, body. This is all of who we are. How's an athlete train for a game? They don't expect to behave a certain way in a game situation unless they've responded that way in practice. Same thing's true for a pianist or a surgeon. So why did Jesus rebuke them for not having faith in the midst of a crisis situation? Because they had had many experiences prior to this that should have been developing their faith to the point that at the moment of crisis, training should have kicked in. It's ridiculous to expect a pianist who's not trained to perform in a concert. It's equally ridiculous to expect a Christian who's not trained in trust, when put to the test, to respond in godly fashion. If you look at the life of Jesus himself, look at what he modeled. He was brilliant. At age 12, he was baffling the greatest minds of his time. And what did he do? Did he go on the child prodigy tour? He went home for 18 more years, subjected himself to family life and work life. And then, after his baptism, he goes and fasts and prays in solitude for a month and a half. And he's on a pretty tight schedule. He's got about 3 years. He spent a lot of time alone. Sometimes he prayed all night before meeting the needs of people. What he was doing was showing us the reality and necessity of training for godliness. And we sometimes make the mistake of thinking that we're going to just sort of show up, game time, game on, event that requires us to go the second mile, turn the other cheek, suffer patiently, and we haven't trained that way. So to have faith doesn't mean that we just try to behave like Jesus did when we're put under pressure. When it's game time, it means that we live our lives like he did, trusting God in the day-to-dayness of life. It's called training. What Jesus did when he's put in pressure situations was a result of what he did the rest of his life. So let me give you some practical examples of what I mean for training for godliness. So you feel like you have this compelling need to exalt yourself. You're in a situation where you just really feel the need to impress people or let them know that you're smart or you've done this or whatever. And you trust God that he's enough, and so you hold your tongue. You feel compelled to defend yourself, but you know you really shouldn't in this situation, so you trust God to be enough, and you don't. You feel like you have to make an ethical, moral shortcut in order to be successful or happy, and you trust God to be enough. You're afraid of looking stupid or being left out or being rejected, or you're afraid your kids aren't going to be as cool or as successful as other kids, and yet you stand down and trust God to be enough. You pray for itty-bitty things in your life. How's that training for godliness? Because if you believe God is alive and real, then you move through life talking to God about your life. This small thing at work. Ambulance goes by. You're praying for somebody you don't know. You pray for itty-bitty things. You're training yourself for godliness. You give thanks consistently for all things in your life. You ask for forgiveness. You move towards people, spouses, friends, who you feel like you don't want to move towards. You decide not to be petty. You believe God's enough. You don't allow thoughts of jealousy, envy. You don't mull over how all the ways people have slighted you or forgotten you. You don't let them lodge in your brain. You exercise through an act of your will and an act of faith. You say, I'm going to put those thoughts out. Those thoughts are terrorists. I'm not going to stay around. You look for ways to bless those who are against you. See, training to trust is not just read the Bible and pray more. It definitely is reading the Bible. It definitely is praying, but it's doing that so you'll know how to practice what faith in Jesus looks like in your real life. And our faith is revealed in our responses to life circumstances like the disciples. On the other hand, our faith is built through our responses to life circumstances. So this advice that my chaplain friend got, trust your training, is that good advice or bad advice for the Christian? I mean, it sounds a little humanistic, trust your training. It depends on your perspective on it. We don't trust our training if by that we mean trust yourself. Trust your strength, your efforts, your wisdom, your experience. That's going to fail us. We don't trust our ability to train, but we do trust that training will lead us forward in a more mature faith. We trust that training is going to take us to a place where our reflexes, our body, our brain, our thinking, our emotions are going to move faster to faith and to fear. God's given us the will. God's put us in a body. He's given us the opportunity to choose to train ourselves for godliness. He's given us a mind that's not just a brain. We can choose what to allow to stay in our minds. He's connected us to individuals and relationships. We can choose how we're going to operate in those relationships. We can exercise faith in all the arenas of who we are so that when big events come, we're more trained to be prepared. I listened to a lady named Naomi Padgett speak last week. She's a crisis response expert, and she said for years our national response to disaster or crisis has been disaster, respond, another disaster, respond, another disaster, respond. And she said after 9/11, there's been a helpful shift for the last 15 years or so to disaster, respond, evaluate, prepare, disaster, respond. And we have a crisis in the past, and we respond to the crisis. Then we get through that, and we go back to life in oblivion as before until another crisis comes. But now, that's changed. And this seems to be a more biblical model for how Christians are to live. Often Christians will not grow in faith because they'll have a crisis. If they get through the crisis, then they go back into their life as it was before until the next crisis comes. But a biblical model includes training. There's evaluation and preparation. I could give you lots of examples. I won't give you the references, but I'll just pull out some phrases from verses. Train yourself for godliness. Prepare your mind for action. Always be prepared to give an answer. Be prepared in season and out of season. Sounds like preparation to me. And then what about evaluation? Test the sincerity of your love. Examine yourself. You see that language all through the New Testament. So clearly the biblical model is not just crisis response back into oblivion, but it's training involved. And training includes evaluation. Where am I? Why am I here? Why did I respond that way? And in preparation, how do I get where I need to be? So maybe someone in this room is in the middle of a storm right now, an emotional, personal, relational storm of some kind, or somebody you know. If you're in the middle of the initial throes of a storm, which you don't need a lot of information or facts. And if you're wondering how to help someone who's in the middle of a crisis event, and you don't know what to say, that's a really helpful thing. If you don't know what to say, don't say anything. Just a ministry of presence is what's most needed. However, once the initial crisis has passed, people need truth. They need facts. They need information. This is true in a physical crisis. It's true in a spiritual crisis. What you believe about God is important. You don't want to give someone who's right there in the middle of a crisis great facts about who God is. You want to just be with them. But once the crisis is over, if you want to help them grow, they need to learn more about who God is. They got to move from crisis response, crisis to crisis response, evaluation, preparation. Part of that means thinking thoughts that are true about God in life. Because what we think in our brains is what we're going to actually act on. and then believing those true thoughts about God in life, and then making decisions day by day that align with those true beliefs about God in life. So how do we think true thoughts about God in life? Well, it requires some training, biblical intake, reading the Bible, listening to sermons, reading good books, reflection. Believing those true thoughts requires what? It requires some prayer, fellowship with like-minded people to embed those things deep inside of us. Making decisions that align with true beliefs require what? A surrendered will to God. Often they require some help from people around us. This is how faith grows. It grows like a muscle grows. You exercise it. Now, Jesus expected his followers to have a better response to the storm than he did, not because he failed to understand the reality of adrenaline and cortisol and norepinephrine. He's a first century guy. He didn't know those things were happening in their brains. Now, Jesus is smart, like really smart, smarter than anybody who's ever lived. He completely understood the chemical response going on in their brains, but he understood much more than that. He knows that we can train for faith as much as we can train for any number of things. His expectation was that the practice of their faith would have better prepared them to respond differently in that situation. And they were going to get there. This was part of, he wasn't just done with them. This is part of their training. So, are you disappointed in how you responded to a certain situation? In fact, I can say, raise your hand if you're disappointed in how you respond to a situation. Don't do it, but I'll just raise my hand collectively for us. I am very disappointed in how I've responded. Have you exhibited more faith, more fear than faith in a situation? So, yeah, we should. I haven't really been afraid of being killed. I'm telling you, fear touches pretty much all of what we do. Fear of what others think, fear of being alone, fear of the future, fear of being bored or ineffective, fear of death or loss of control, fear of my kids not being cool or whatever. Fear pretty much dominates all of our stupid choices. And so when you think about some of the choices you've made, probably fear was a part of that. And the opposite of fear is not courage, it's faith. Now, as a friend of mine pointed out, and I agree, faith is going to lead to courageous actions, but our culture tends to think that the opposite of fear is courage. It's really not. The opposite of fear is faith. Faith that believes God is enough. Faith that what God thinks matters the most does matter the most. Faith that I'm not alone. Faith that I no more have to fear what will happen in the future than I need to fear what will happen in the past. God's in control of that. So this rebuke was not a slap in the face, but it was an invitation to a different kind of life. And it was not going to happen magically, even by just hanging out with Jesus. Now, you would think if it's going to happen by hanging out, it would have happened to these guys, because they're hanging out with Jesus himself. And it wasn't happening just by hanging out. It was going to take some intention on their part, some experience. It happens by choice. So train yourself to be godly. This is not in opposition to grace. This is in cooperation with grace. Let's pray together. Maybe, like me, you're disappointed with your response to circumstances of life, that you would like to be further along in your faith. And here is the thing you can pray about. You can rejoice in the fact that God is willing and able to help you grow. And he's inviting you to enter into training. And this kind of training is a really joyful thing. It's a partnership with the Holy Spirit in godliness. So talk to him about that.